everyone. My name is Kyren Skinner, and I'm the W. Glenn Campbell Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And I welcome you to Hoover's Capital Conversations. The Hoover Institution is one of the nation's leading research centers with a mission dedicated to producing policy ideas that promote economic prosperity, national security, and democratic governance. To tell you a little bit about Capital Conversations, this is a series where Hoover Fellows get to talk policy with actual policymakers. We invite you to participate in a dialogue about some of today's most pressing issues. In this discussion, we'll be talking with Senator Rand Paul about foreign policy and the current state of international alliances. As part of the discussion, we will take audience questions and encourage you to submit yours at the Q&A button located at the bottom of your screen. Let me just say a quick word about Senator Paul. He is someone, as you know, who ran for president in 2016. And I had the honor of being on his presidential campaign as one of his foreign policy advisors. We've stayed in touch in the past few years, and I have seen him, along with many of my colleagues, as one of the best kind of theorists of the emerging foreign policy in the 21st century, one in which the United States continues to be engaged in the world, but shows more restraint. Senator Paul is from the great state of Kentucky, and he's known for advocating liberty and championing fiscal responsibility. He currently serves on these committees in the U.S. Senate: Homeland Security and Government Affairs, the Committee on Small Business and Entrepreneurship, the Committee on Health, Education, and Labor, and the Committee on Foreign Relations. Senator, welcome, and thank you for being here.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm glad I can join you today.
And it's good to see you on screen. We have a number of questions that we'd like to ask, and I think I'll start by asking you about your book, The Case Against Socialism. Why did you write that book? What are the themes that you'd like to share from that book with this particular audience? And how do you think it's relevant for the presidential race?
You know, I think it's still relevant today. If you asked me 10 years ago, was socialism relevant? I would say with the fall of the Berlin Wall and with the collapse of communism, socialism had such a bad name that I thought it would never raise its head again, really. But with the popularity of Bernie Sanders, I think socialism has come back. And I think it's important to look around the world when we talk about foreign relations and look at the historic examples of how socialism really hasn't got such a great track record. And I think one of the questions that our book tries to answer is, can you have a kinder, gentler socialism? Can you have a democratic socialism that's not so bad? And I think that one of the themes that we explore is that perhaps violence is inevitable with socialism. And what I mean by that is that if you ultimately want socialism, which is sort of the ownership of the means of production, government will own the means of production. Somebody already owns the means of production in every society, even in a primitive society, somebody already owns it. So you can have partial socialism where you only just take part of people's stuff, part of people's property, or you regulate their property. But ultimately, when you come to take their property, when you want to complete the task of land ownership, home ownership, et cetera, by the state, people resist. And so people say, well, Stalin, you know, he was just an accident. Hitler, another accident. Pol Pot, an accident. Mao, these are just sort of accidents. I don't know why. People don't even explain it, but we tend to get these dictators. But others argue that they're actually an inevitability, because if you want to have complete socialism, if you want to have the government have complete ownership of things, when you go to take it from people, they resist. So socialism actually selects for the most ruthless among us. It's not an accident that we get ruthless dictators from socialism. If you want socialism, they're not very effective if they say, please give me your property. Their effectiveness comes with their ruthlessness. And so really, it's not an accident of history. It isn't like, oh, we're not going to get Hitler anymore. We're not going to get Stalin. Those were accidents of the last century. No, if you want socialism again, if you truly want to take the means of production or take the vast majority of people's earnings from them, there's a point at which they resist, and then the state must resort to violence.
And do you see that conversation really taking place in this campaign, given that there are such stark differences between the Democrats and Republicans, especially at the level of the presidential race?
You know, I think sometimes when my wife and I are involved, she helped me write the book, we're always talking about socialism. But we're also talking about, in addition to sort of the economics of it, we're talking about what is and what isn't socialism. Because many of today's contemporary democratic socialists, Bernie Sanders, AOC, they say they're for Sweden. But the interesting thing is, when you look at the Swedish or the Nordic model of socialism, it actually isn't socialism at all. It's a large taxpayer-funded welfare state, but they still have private property. They still have a private stock exchange. They have pretty much free and open trade with the world. So they really aren't socialist. In fact, one of the ironies is Swedish tax policies, the opposite of what Bernie's for. They've had low corporate taxes for a long time. Until we lowered our corporate taxes recently, we were actually higher than Sweden for several decades. As far as taxes on the poor, Bernie says, oh no, we're just going to tax the rich. AOC, they're just going to tax the rich. And yet, when you look at Sweden, the way their welfare model works and the way they have enough money to make everything so-called free is they tax the heck out of everybody, particularly the working class. The working class and everyone pays a 25% value-added tax. This makes the Swedish system actually much more regressive than ours. So the most important people for young people to understand, if they're telling you Sweden's so great, we want to be socialists like Sweden, it involves a very regressive, very onerous tax on the middle class. You want to buy a car in Sweden? It's a 100% tax. If you buy a $30,000 car, it's going to cost you $30,000 to get a car. So when you see all these healthy Swedes walking around with the ruddy cheeks, they're not doing that because of choice. They're doing that because nobody can afford a car because of the taxes. But people need to understand what Sweden is and need to understand what true socialism is. And really, before we glorify, and I think there's a danger in glorifying socialism, because historically millions of people have died at the hands of socialism.
That's kind of a powerful statement to make. And I think many Americans would love to have ruddy cheeks and walk around more and not drive cars. I'm one of them. But the price that we have to pay for that lifestyle, I think, is what you've been trying to emphasize. And in a way, it is a subtext of this presidential race. But let me move on to another question, which I think among the U.S. senators, you're perhaps most uniquely qualified to answer. We've heard the president since 2016 talk about America First as an emerging strategic doctrine for the United States. And it's been debated because many people say it harkens back to the America First Committee of the interwar period that included Charles Lindbergh and his statements against Jews and others as a reason not to go to war. But those on the side of what the president has been saying have argued that, in fact, it's very different, that it represents a more restraint-oriented U.S. foreign policy. I know that's something you advocate. Could you tell us your version of America First and this emerging strategic policy?
I don't think President Trump refers to America First in any sort of historical context of Lindbergh or anti-Semitism or anything like that. I think he refers to it in a very literal way, America First, that we have to think about ourselves before we think about others. And really, this is even in some ways a mandate to most individual families. You say, you know, are you your neighbor's keeper? Yeah, but most people say you should provide for your own family before you have to make sure you're feeding your kids before you feed other kids. That's sort of what America First is. But also, we have to realize that so much of our money that flows out of our treasury around the world is being wasted in other countries, and we have needs here at home. The best example is probably Afghanistan, where we spend about $50 billion a year, but all kinds of wasteful things happen. We build highways for them. They can't take care of the highways. We build gas stations for them. In fact, we built them a natural gas station. Nobody in America even has a car that runs on natural gas. Most people in Afghanistan don't have any cars at all. The average person makes about $800 a year. Well, we built them a natural gas station because the idea of going green and reducing the carbon footprint of Afghanistan somehow has infected our military. And that, to me, I think is absurd, really obscene, that we are spending, like some say, as much as 20% of the dollars are going to some sort of, you know, green carbon footprint thing in Afghanistan. They cook their meals on open fires often in Afghanistan. Anyway, we built a natural gas station for them. It was supposed to cost $500,000. They had 83 cost overruns, and in the end, it cost $45 million. My staff went there to look at it, and guess what? It was too dangerous to take them there. Nobody's even seen it. Nobody knows whether it still exists. And we've actually heard from people who've been there that it doesn't exist anymore after $45 million. There was a luxury hotel built in Kabul, and the contractor ran off with half the money. It was like a $90 million hotel. The shell of it still sits there. America First means we look to our roads, our schools, our students first. And then if we have some left over, that's why I say, look, if you've got a surplus in the budget and you want to spend some money on soft power and goodwill around the world, God love you, go ahead. Yeah, I'm waiting for the first surplus budget to have that discussion. As long as there's a deficit, I tell people, it's like, you know, somebody in your town needs help. It'd be like you going to the bank and borrowing $1,000 to give to a charity. Nobody does that. You give out of your surplus. You don't give borrowed money to help people. But that's what the United States is doing. And America First says we got to right our fiscal house first. And we also need to make sure we're not giving money to countries that actually hate us, burn our flag, and really aren't pro-America. And that's been going on for too long as well, giving money to people who actually really are not our friends.
Thank you for clarifying some of the ideas around America First and for making it plain that the president is using the term to explain America's role now, and it's not connected to any other use of that term at various points in U.S. history. But with everything that you've said, and I, of course, now I ask the audience to submit their questions using the Q&A function at the bottom of their screen, there are still people who think that we're not on the right course in U.S. foreign policy. And that leads me to my next question. What is your biggest disagreement with POTUS in the foreign policy arena?
You know, I agree with the concept of trying to end the war in Afghanistan, bring the troops home from Iraq. I would do it quicker. You know, I also wouldn't have sent more troops to Saudi Arabia. I think troops in Saudi Arabia, one, Saudi Arabia's killing of the journalist Khashoggi, I think, was abominable. Mm-hmm. If anything, we should have punished them by saying, you don't get any weapons until reassure us that this is not a brutal regime you're going to be. And so I think we did the opposite with that. So I haven't really agreed with the support of Saudi Arabia so much or putting troops there. The main reason we shouldn't have troops there is if you look for something that is a unifying radical call to jihad, it's troops in Saudi Arabia. To Muslims, it's a big deal to have foreign troops, you know, in Mecca and Medina. They actually don't allow Christians, for the most part, to go to these cities, much less having soldiers in their country. So to certain, radicalized Muslims, it's a big deal to have U.S. troops there. And I think it'll be a stimulus to more conflict. So I wouldn't have sent the troops there. But on removing troops from the Middle East, winding down the wars, and being more about defending America as opposed to being involved in all these regime change civil wars. I've been largely with the president on that.
Thank you. I have the first question from the audience, and let me read it to you. Free stuff has been attractive for people who believe the government can give them something without taking away from you or others first. What has to happen to the system of education? Teach economics in K-12, get back to civics? Your response, Senator.
Well, the one reason why people are led to believe that you can get something for nothing and that it doesn't come from someone else is that we borrow it. And so the deficit hides the pain. If we had to raise taxes to pay for all the COVID bailouts, we'd have had to raise taxes $4 trillion. People would be feeling it, it would be coming from them. But it's sort of this artificial feeling that you get when you either print money or borrow money that's allowed this to happen. How do we get this better? Education is part of the answer. You know, Hoover Institute, Hillsdale College, Grove City College, different conservative universities that have come forward and have been teaching generation after generation of economists, people who write books. Look, after World War II and the period of time after World War II, our universities were completely dominated by socialists and Marxists, but there were a few people. And they actually, a lot of them knew each other. Ayn Rand was one of them. Ludwig von Mises was one of them. Henry Hazlitt was one of them. Leonard Reed was another. And their books still sort of educate another generation. Milton Friedman, not necessarily that group of friends, but that sort of same crowd. And there, even today, people can YouTube a Milton Friedman, you know, talk about somebody who can explain something in a very succinct, incredible way. Friedman had a real talent, but that's where it is. And so when people ask me, let's say someone's a billionaire and they want to help me in my campaign, I say, yes, that's great. But I say also support our universities because the universities, some of them are a complete waste. I mean, some of them are just awful what's going on now, the terrible censorship and the ideas coming out of these universities. So yeah, we, the conservatives and those who succeed, if any of your students are listening, go out and become the next generation of great capitalists, give back to their universities, the good ones, and make sure your money is contingent on teaching free market economics. But that's where it's gotta come from. And some of it we won, like on the ideas of trade, the universities, for the most part, became bastions of free trade over the last 30 or 40 years and away from protectionism. That's another area where President Trump and I aren't exactly on the same page. But for the most part, the free market economists did teach free trade over the last 30 or 40 years, and the universities, it became much more of a prominent idea over time. But it is part of its education, its activism, its politics, there's all of the above.
I love this question because I say the issue isn't K-12. I always reframe it to say it's K-16 to include what happens in undergraduate education to our young people. And that's the basically what your response is about. At the Hoover Institution, we have been doing more in the education space, including the Capital Conversations, which are open to the public, and students join as well. We've had a summer boot camp in the past few years for kind of a deep dive opportunity around economic prosperity, national security for students. And as of last week, our new director is Condoleezza Rice, who has spent more than 40 years at Stanford educating students. So I think Hoover is in the space of what you're talking about. And it's exciting to watch how in this COVID period, we're using this medium of Zoom and others to reach out to literally thousands of people weekly. But let me go on to a question that just came up. And I think it's a good one. It's a straightforward one. What's the difference between communism and socialism?
No, I think the quick answer is that socialism is the economic system of communism. Communism is basically, you know, one thinks of more of a specific brand of socialism. You know, they think of Soviet communism, but the economic system is socialism. The government owns the means of production. And this is important. We go into this in the book some because Hitler, you know, has rightfully been condemned by history. But because of the mass killings and the Holocaust, he's remembered for that. And the left has sort of obscured that he was a socialist. He was proud of his socialism. In fact, he was so proud of it that he named it National Socialism because he wasn't talking about, he wanted to brand his as a German National Socialism. But nevertheless, it was socialism with the government controlling the economy. And but socialism is the economic culprit. That is the economic system of the government owning the means of production. And in complete socialism, the government owns everything. There is no private property. And if you look at the Democrat Socialist of America, it's much softer language than that. But that's essentially what they say. The group that AOC belongs to eventually will say, well, certain industries have to be owned by the government. But they don't explain to you, well, how are we going to do that? Are you just going to take them? How do you nationalize industries other than putting the owners in jail or putting them in chains? How do you take things that are previously owned and make them owned by everyone? The other response is that people always often will say is when everyone owns something, no one really owns it and no one really cares about it. Walter Williams has been great at pointing that out, that if you want to care for things, even the environment, the more of the environment that is owned, the more you care about it, you know, and actually private conservation in our country has actually done a great deal towards helping the environment. Many of our national parks were actually given by the capitalists, the Rockefellers, you know, back to the country.
Thank you for that answer. And we have others coming along. I'm multitasking here, looking at questions and keeping up with you. So if I look away, it's not because I'm uninterested, but I'm trying to respond to the numerous questions that we have from the audience, which is a great sign. Here's the next one. What is your take on recent China tension with China? How would you have the U.S. respond to the Chinese policy toward Hong Kong?
I think this is the difficulty of foreign policy, and particularly the difficulty of either being a president or someone in a public position, because there's the realism aspect that understands that we're going to have to deal with people we don't like and we don't agree with and who actually, frankly, aren't very good on human rights. But then there's the sort of being the representative of a country and the conscience to say certain things really are wrong and they should be condemned. I mean, look, for goodness sakes, Navalny, this is Russia, but you know, he's poisoned by a nerve gas that's really only available to the Russian military and the Russian government. And so, yes, that should be condemned. But at the same time, whether it's China or Russia, I haven't been for advocating, you know, isolationism. I don't think we should isolate from China or isolate from Russia. And so I think there has to be rebukes. For example, with the whole coronavirus origins in Wuhan, I think one of the rebukes should be, it sounds like there may have been corruption between the WHO and Chinese government. That should be investigated. And actually agree with the president on this. And this is something President Trump will do, but virtually no other Republican would do, withhold their money until we get an investigation. I've introduced the same amendment in the Senate, withhold their money till we get an investigation. But I wouldn't vote to eliminate trade with China. So for example, if we want to make more things here, particularly pharmaceuticals, antibiotics, let's get rid of the regulations that make it cost $1 billion to get a drug through the FDA process. But let's don't, you know, have a, you know, a 300% tariff or something. You know, right now, if you talk about drug prices, the best way, the worst thing to do would be to blockade drugs coming in from China because our drug prices would double and triple. So that's not a good idea. So we have to be careful how we do it, but it doesn't mean we should give them a free pass. And I think they do deserve rebuke. And I think the president standing up to them has driven a harder bargain on some of the trade treaties. And while I don't lean as protectionist as the president does, also in some ways see what he does and says, well, you know, maybe it is time somebody does stand up and drive a harder bargain.
We have some more questions coming in, and there's interest in your take, having attended the president's talk at the Republican National Convention and having left and you know, suffered some harassment as you and your wife exited that event. What are your thoughts about the cancel culture in the United States? Those are two words now that I think everyone has some thoughts about. We'd like to hear yours.
Well, particularly with regard to the universities, I think it's an abomination that we're trying to, you know, cancel people or, constrict what they're able to say as far as freedom of speech. One that's in the news today is, you know, Nick Sandman was that high school student who was just smiling as that Native American activist was banging a drum in his face. And there were activists there yelling and screaming at these kids who were just waiting on the bus and who in all likelihood is now winning civil suits against CNN and other organizations who lied about the whole event. That's a cancel kind of culture, but he's going to Transylvania University in my state, and already a professor singling him out and saying by name. I'll be watching him closely, and if he says or breaks any of the ethical rules of the university, I will be filing complaints against him. Somebody else said he shouldn't be admitted because of his political views, and it's like, my goodness, isn't that the opposite of what we believe? And it's like, you know, Hoover Institute, great institution. I get out there, we don't always agree with everybody in the Hoover Institute, but they heard my opinions, we had healthy dialogue, and I appreciate the Hoover Institute. But you know, if there's a left-wing group at Stanford, I'm all for letting them exist as well. We shouldn't be restricting speech. Have an honest intellectual debate with people, but the cancel culture is something that should alarm us all, because we're really talking about one of our bedrock principles of being able to speak our mind. And if we're limiting it to certain subjects, and see, Europe is even worse than us. Europe has limited it. There's a lot of things you can't say in Europe now. We're at least still freer than Europe when speech comes. But when people on the right are talking about getting on the internet and having a governmental group decide what can be said, because they say, oh, well, Facebook's too far to the left, or Twitter's too far to the left, we need to regulate Facebook, and we need to have a government commission decide, you know, how many conservatives can be on there. And I'm like, oh my goodness, are you guys crazy? You know, I don't like private censorship, but I'll turn them off. I'll get off Facebook or off Twitter if I don't like. I'm on Parler to partially protest, I think, Twitter, you know, doing things to their algorithm to hurt conservatives. But there are always ways to tune to another channel. But letting the government decide on speech or universities decide speech is a terrible, terrible idea.
There's a question that's come in that I think is right up your alley. It's one that I think your father also cared about. How do you think we repay the federal deficit? And what about the level of U.S. debt?
You know, I think the debt is a real danger to us. And will it be repaid? Yes, it's sort of like the answer with Social Security checks. Will the checks go out? The checks always go out. The interest checks will always go to the Federal Reserve. But the question is, what will the money be worth? And there have been times in history when nations have destroyed their currency. This is what concerns me about the level of debt in such a short period of time. We could wind up with $5 trillion of additional debt just in the last 6 months or so. To put that in context, I complained about George W. Bush when he went from $5 trillion to $10 trillion in 8 years. George W. Bush added $5 trillion in 8 years. President Obama added $10 trillion in 8 years. Now we're adding $5 trillion in a year. That is just alarming. And interest payments, even at low interest, are consuming more and more of the budget. But imagine what happens. And this is something I don't think people realize. We do not always have complete control over interest rates. There are times when interest rates escape the people and their responses to money. Sometimes interest rates will escape the control of the Federal Reserve. If we went to 5 or 8, when I was a teenager in high school, the interest rate went to 19, 20, 21%. If that happened right now with this burden of debt, it would consume the entire budget. We wouldn't have any money for anything else. And then the only way they'd pay for it is the way they do it in Venezuela, print more, or Zimbabwe, print more, more, more. So there is a danger. Deficits do matter. And this separates out some Republicans. There's very few Republicans in the Senate who believe the deficits matter. They just, you know, they are Keynesians to the end of time. And they're like, oh, look, everybody's doing fine in our economy. Well, yeah, we just printed up and gave out $5 trillion. Can we do that every 2 months? The other disadvantage to borrowing to try to keep the economy going is it doesn't send the correct signal to the governors. If there is not an economic punishment for shutting the economy down, they'll keep the economy closed. So if we give them any more money, you're giving them more time to keep the economy closed. That's a huge mistake. I keep debating with all these people. I had the head of NIH in today, and I made sure that he had to listen to me repeat four times to him that the death rate for COVID under age 25 is 0.6 per million. Less than one person per million will die less than age 25. We just saw a statistic today, 15,000 kids have gotten COVID in colleges. The hospitalization rate, virtually zero. I'm not saying it's a benign disease, but for young people, it is a pretty benign disease. For older people, it's a much worse disease, but we shouldn't have our colleges shut down. And also, we shouldn't have our economy shut down. The longer we do, you know, what happens if Biden wins in November or December? What are they going to cut? They're going to come looking for $2 or $3 trillion more. What will they do next spring? $2 or $3 trillion more. What is the breaking point for when you destroy a currency? Nobody knows exactly what that breaking point is, but people have been warning for years that when your debt equals your gross domestic product, which is about where we are now, $26 trillion and change, that this is an alarming time and we have to be very, very concerned about how much debt we have.
The discussion of COVID-19 could have been our entire time together. I'm glad that you mentioned it, and and to try to bring some realism to the discussion about death rates, I think is critical. There's still a lot of confusion in our country about the disease process, and so I'd like to ask you more, but I have a pressing question from the audience. What should be done about economic disparity in the United States? I think this is actually an important question, and COVID-19 makes it a lot clearer to people what that disparity looks like in terms of, you know, the lives of our fellow citizens. We're thinking about it in the university world, both at the Hoover Institution, at Stanford, at Carnegie Mellon University, where I also teach. It's a critical issue. Your thoughts?
When economic disparity is caused by government policy, the government policy should change. So for example, in socialist society, you have economic disparity and kleptocracy. Basically, if your brother to Castro or your nephew or daughter to Castro, you get to partake in the billions that he steals from the people or that he did steal from the people. In our society, it's not so apparent, the kleptocracy, but the Federal Reserve, by keeping interest low, what they do is that they've created a situation where everybody's money goes into the stock market. And so those who are sophisticated enough or have enough wealth can multiply their wealth many times over in the stock market because of Federal Reserve policy that keeps interest rates low. The ordinary people who aren't sophisticated enough or have enough money to get into investments in the market are somewhat prohibited, so economic disparity can get worse. With all that being said, though, it's important for people to know that Thomas Piketty was completely wrong in everything he wrote. He's a socialist, and it all came from his proposition that socialism is the way to go and that we should have a high progressive income tax. If you look at income inequality and you measure economic growth, Thomas Piketty's argument was that the more income inequality, the less economic growth you'll get, that there's a tipping point. There are others who have looked at this, and it's been looked at repeatedly by many economists, and there are many economists who say actually that's untrue and that economic growth is actually proportional to income inequality. And in our book, In the Case Against Socialism, my wife and I tell this story, and we ask people, which society would you rather live in, where the average poor people make $10,000 and the average rich person makes $50,000, Or would you rather live in a society where the average poor person makes $30,000, but the average rich person makes $3 million? See, the thing is, it should be about your own economics. When we compare ourselves to other, you're setting yourself up for sort of a jealousy trope. You're setting yourself up to be looking at someone else's income and saying, oh my goodness, that person has three cars and I have one, or that person's got a Bentley and I've got a Ford. And that's about jealousy and covetousness, and that is not really helpful to anyone. And the other story we tell is a story from somewhere behind the Iron Curtain, and it's Boris and Igor, and they, you know, Boris is given three wishes, and he says, you could have anything, you know? And he says, well, you know, his buddy Igor's got one goat, and he's got no goat. And he says, well, I wish Igor's goat would die. And it's like, he didn't wish himself $1 million. He wished evil on the other person. So it is really about not thinking about your own wealth. If you look at our wealth, even with economic disparity, and humanprogress.org is a great organization and a website that talks about this, we are so much richer than we've ever been. If you look at in 1820, 90% or greater lived on $2 a day, which is considered to be extreme poverty. You carry that forward with constant dollars. Today, less than 10% of the world live on $2 a day. That's how much we've improved. Everybody's getting richer. Now, there's a disparity, yeah, but unless you're going to sit around all day and mope about somebody you know makes more money than you do, it should be about your own economic circumstances. As far as food, you can buy 7 times as much food for the same hours as you could 100 years ago. A refrigerator, in the 1950s, it took about 120 hours of the average worker's wages to buy a refrigerator. Now it takes like 15 hours. So the thing is through productivity and through advancements and science, we live in a great world. Everybody's moaning about it. America's the best place to live. And this is the best time in history, not just in America, but worldwide to be alive. Antibiotics, anesthesia, you name it. I mean, what a great place. Everybody's out there moaning. They need to look at the truth of the matter. I mean, we live in a great world compared to every other world you could ever imagine.
Thank you, Senator. They're telling me that we're at time. I have so many more questions to ask you. I know that you're super busy in the halls of Congress, but I have to ask a really quick question that I hope you can give a short answer to. We can pretend we're on Jeopardy. Are you hopeful or despondent?
Very, very hopeful when I think about what capitalism can generate and has generated and where we're headed. Not always so hopeful for government, but fortunately, the economy thrives despite government. And the real engine of what's going on is outside of government. We place all this importance on government and what government does. The real beauty of the world are the entrepreneurs, men and women who borrow money, create jobs, and do things, and they do it despite the obstacles government places. So I'm pessimistic the government will do a lot with debt, this and that, but I'm optimistic of what freedom brings, where we've come with the Industrial Revolution last 200 years. I think that there really are no limits to what we can do, and people should be optimistic. But this is what we need to tell people who are out in the streets. It's a great time to be alive. Go out there and work hard. There's all kinds of opportunities for everybody. Probably more opportunities for people, regardless of race or creed or gender or any of that stuff, than there's ever been at any time in our history. Go out there and grab, you know, work hard and do well. And don't be so pessimistic that, you know, people are telling you, no, you have to go break a shop window or something. That's not true. There's a lot of good going on in the world, and all you gotta do is work hard and get an education and be part of it.
Thank you for that. My students need to hear those words, and I'm going to require that they listen to this conversation. We do need a shot of optimism in our conversation now, as we're facing so many overlapping crises, and this is an unprecedented time. But that's all the time we have today. Senator Paul, I want to thank you for the time that you've given us and for this great conversation. It's very much like the ones that I've had with you privately. I'll tell the audience he's incredibly consistent in what he believes and has to say, and that's really reassuring. But before I let you go, I have to put a plug in for our next Capital Conversation. It will be September 16th at 10 a.m. Pacific time, and which means 1 p.m. Eastern time, with Senator Josh Hawley and my Hoover colleague, research fellow, Lan He Chin. They'll discuss, among all things, technology and the new economy. You can find out more by going to the Hoover website, hoover.org/capital conversations. I hope you'll tune in. We have many more of these conversations coming on. Once again, thank you to the Senator. This was a great time.